these blessings on to the people who are in need of them. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Jawad, alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
And now we invite you to listen to a shorter speech by Sheikh Ayub Rashid.
Respected brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, according to what he mentioned to his companions, he said that my time when it comes to the end, Imam after me will be Al-Hasan al-Askari, my son. And then after him, the Imam who will be the Imam is his son, Al-Mahdi ajjalallahu faraja, yamla'u al-arda qistan wa adla, ba'dama muli'at dhulman wa jawra. When he comes, he will fill this world with peace and equity after it has been filled with corruption and injustice. Now, when you know that Imam al-Jawad made clear that after him, who will be the leader? And after his son, he mentioned the name of the 12th Imam. Then you live at peace. You cannot go wrong to say, I don't know my Imams.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parsetoday.com/EN, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The Saudi coalition has seized another fuel ship bound for Yemen, keeping it from reaching the port of Hodeidah to unload the much-needed fuel. Military officials based in Sana'a confirmed that they have not ruled out the military option against the Saudi coalition in order to prevent what they call acts of piracy in the Red Sea.
I can confidently say that in the near future or in the days ahead, we will all witness an escalation of military operations, and perhaps we are going to see a one-of-a-kind military operation that will target the vessels in the Red Sea that are pirating Yemeni fuel ships which have received the necessary permits from the United Nations. The Yemeni army could also target the oil industry in both Saudi Arabia and the UAE. I can certainly assure you that the status quo is going to change, as military officials' strategic patience is wearing thin.
According to the spokesperson for the Yemeni Petroleum Company, Isam al-Mutawakkil, all Yemeni fuel ships are forced to sail on a path crossing near the Saudi Arabian coastal area of Jazan, where an American base is believed to be operating.
All Yemeni fuel ships bound for Yemen have been seized and fallen victim to these acts of piracy near the Saudi coastal area of Jizan, where they are searched under American supervision. This is happening despite the fact that they are already being inspected by Djibouti. Therefore, we should hold accountable the Saudi and American coalition along with the United Nations, which is allowing these acts of piracy that are causing great harm to the Yemeni people.
Yemeni military and political personnel have expressed that a peaceful solution will be impossible if the humanitarian situation continues to deteriorate due to a limited supply of fuel and diesel. Tensions are also on the rise in the strategic province of Hodeidah, where coalition forces are reportedly building up.
If there is not going to be a peaceful or political solution, then perhaps the solution is going to come through the barrel of our rifles in order to stop these aggressor nations which are taking orders from their American and Zionist masters.
As 2022 draws to an end, so do all efforts for a peaceful solution. However, as the humanitarian situation continues to grow worse by the day in Yemen, the military option could be the only option left on the table.
The Yemeni government, based in the capital Sana'a, has proved that it has the military capability to hit long-range targets in land and at sea. However, it is still keen to reach a political solution and end the conflict that has taken the lives of tens of thousands of innocent people. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
About 70 officials and representatives of think tanks and research centers from 36 countries are in Tehran to attend the Tehran Dialogue Forum 2022. The initiative, dubbed Neighborhood Policy of the Islamic Republic of Iran, is the third of its kind, and this time it focuses on regional friendship and trust building.
The main message of this forum is boosting regional cooperation and dialogue. We always welcome dialogue, particularly when it comes to finding solutions to the challenges that we face.
The keynote speakers of the forum, former Iranian Foreign Minister Kamal Kharrazi, the former Prime Minister of Iraq Adel Abdel Mahdi, the Nicaraguan Foreign Minister Denis Ronaldo Moncada, and other participants reiterated the same stance, giving Iran credit for the initiative.
This is important in order to strengthen your policy in the regional dimension. Due to the new dimension in the whole world and new world order that is much more focused on regionalism than as on the wide international arena.
Pakistan and Iran are the only two countries that are always directly affected by Afghanistan. So I think the Tehran Dialogue Forum is very important in that regard, that there has to be regional dialogue. And Iran being at the forefront of this is a welcoming development. And I think, look, it's important for the region to take ownership. And we see Iran doing that through this forum. And I think it's important, again, to discuss through dialogue to move forward towards any cooperation.
The message of the forum, however, is not limited to regional countries.
We could only really build peace if we do it through dialogue and with the diversity of participation. So I think we are grateful for the invitation to Venezuela, and we think it's important to address this. Even though we're not from the region of Iran, we also think in regional terms. Venezuela is part of Latin America and the Caribbean. We are a zone of peace, as we decreed it in 2014, and we think that it is important for the different regions of the world to establish communication and see how we can really face common challenges.
The first and second rounds of the Tehran Dialogue Forum were held in 2019 and 2020, and as always, addressing the latest developments in West Asia will be on top of the agenda.
The discussions of the Tehran Dialogue Forum 2022 will continue in four different panels, focusing on regional security, energy security, the Ukraine crisis, and the prospects of peace in Afghanistan. Yusumi Shahmadi, Tehran.
The first Iranian-made particle accelerator.
The high-tech device produces high-energy beams by accelerating electrons close to the speed of light. Developed by Iran's Nuclear Science and Technology Research Institute, the Dynamitron-type accelerator was unveiled at the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran on Saturday.
We aim to generate 20% of the country's electricity from nuclear energy and the use of radiation technology. We focused on various accelerators and radiation systems, which can serve a wide range of needs in society. It's a technology that improves the health sector and can be used in food security and environmental preservation.
The Iranian accelerator will be used for food irradiation, cable and wire manufacturing, tire industries, sewage treatment, and sterilization of medical devices. The AEOI says the machine will also be employed in treating cancer patients.
The applications of this technology are numerous, but compared to developed countries, we have stepped into the field of particle accelerators about 50 years later. In fact, we have possessed this technology for a long time, but it was limited to research purposes.
Particle accelerators were first invented in the 1960s to study high-energy particle collisions, but it didn't take scientists long to notice their byproduct, and that is an extremely bright light that can be used in investigating the structure of crystals and proteins, monitoring air pollution, studying disease mechanisms, HD imaging, and cancer radiation therapy, among other applications.
With a wide range of applications, from medicine to agriculture, the homegrown accelerator, as put by its developers, will transform different industries in Iran. Experts here say for sanctions hit Iran, building such a high-tech device is more than an achievement, but a miracle. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Afghan people have been calling for transparent and impartial investigations into crimes and wrongdoings by NATO forces on their soil. Among them, relatives of victims of the NATO war in southern Helmand province are demanding justice for the killing of 54 unarmed people by British Special Air Service troops there. The dead include children. Afghans want the murderers should be held accountable.
Helmand province witnessed deadly night raids and airstrikes by NATO forces, especially those of the UK. Besides, civilian captives were tortured and shot dead. In one case, children were thrown off military planes. I remember so many atrocities by the foreign forces in which civilians were harmed. We call for those British and American perpetrators to be tried in an impartial and transparent court. They should be brought to account and victims should receive compensation.
However, the UK government has announced the start of an inquiry into wrongdoings by its forces in Afghanistan, but some experts say only transparent probes by independent bodies can help make headway with the case. They believe investigations by foreign governments could cover up the facts about the gross violations at the hands of their forces in Afghanistan. During the two-decade US invasion, Afghanistan witnessed much disgrace by NATO troops. More and more facts are emerging regarding unlawful killings and gross violations by foreign forces on Afghan soil. The U.S. war on Afghanistan has left many Afghans in great suffering. People here are calling for accountability and justice for years of gross violation by the NATO troops. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Family members of the victims of the Itaewon tragedy and thousands of their supporters remembered those 158 mostly young people whose lives were taken in a crowd crush October 29th. Some read letters to their lost loved ones.
Last year, we made a whole bunch of snow ducks all around outside our apartment. Please come and see me in my dreams sometimes. Please come see me someday. Maybe even as my future child. I love you forever, Seon.
Although tens of thousands were gathered, police did not manage the crowds and ignored emergency calls hours before the deadly crush. Among those who perished in the tragedy, 26 of them were foreigners. Five of those were Iranian. And like many of the young people who died that evening, they were students who visited South Korea to get more experience in the world and primarily more education to better themselves. Victims' families want the truth and those responsible brought to justice, A class action lawsuit is suing the government, which has often deflected responsibility and blamed the victims. It reminds some of the ferry sinking in 2014, in which more than 300 people died.
The law should be a law to punish wrong people, but the government is humiliating, insulting, and degrading the victims and the families of the deceased. In the end, I think this happened because the Sewol ferry accident was not properly resolved.
Tonight marked the 49th day since the tragedy, signifying the end of the mourning period, when the spirit of those dead to be reborn reaches Buddha and bliss. Frank Smith, Seoul.
It's a daybreak. Raju Yadav is piling up his stock for the delivery in the retail market. He's delighted, saying markets are picking good pace and prices in the whole markets are not fluctuating since last quarter. Earlier, I would buy limited stock, he says. But since the prices are consistent and demand is satisfactory, I have bought more stock than usual. I'm testing my luck, he says. Many Indians like Raju are optimistic as the country is picking up pace as the fast-growing major economy.
We are not strictly a very heavily exporting nation. Most of our producers actually rely on our domestic market. But exports are important for us because we do import some very critical commodities.
Experts say with COVID outbreak shaking major economies, India maintained its consistency in almost all sectors except the manufacturing and employment, which they say is like a diesel engine and needs a major boost. Many economic experts say investments are flowing smoothly in the world's second most populous nation, adding the country needs to revitalize its manufacturing sector, job creation, and address bottlenecks in power, mining, and infrastructure.
More than the economy, I would say our problem, what the manufacturing sector can boost is good jobs, you know, which all Indians will agree are lacking in India. I mean, that's why so many of us go abroad, right? Because these good jobs are lacking, we are wasting our talent. And the reason is that we have never seriously thought about how to make manufacturing grow.
India growth forecast is projected at 7% despite turbulent markets and war in Ukraine that shook markets. Based on Morgan Stanley and S&P Global, the country is projected to overtake Japan and Germany to become the third largest economy by 2030. Economic experts say trade tensions between the United States and China will also open up new opportunities for India as the companies are considering India for production capacity as a second option. Many, however, argue India needs double-digit growth, which would be vital for the second most populous nation, where a huge workforce and young professionals join the market every year, besides lifting millions out of poverty. While the coronavirus pandemic ravaged the world's economy, India managed to mitigate the impact of the outbreak, mainly by relying on its domestic market. But experts say the economic growth is expected to fall in the coming months as the country grapples with high inflation, rising unemployment, and a spike in oil prices, and also a threat of global economic recession. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Protests through Brussels on Friday was organized by Belgium's three largest unions. They claim the country's federal government and EU authorities are failing to adequately help citizens during the current escalating cost of living crisis. Many also question how the EU is able to set aside at least 20 billion euro for Ukraine in 2023.
We are all against this war because it's about imperialism, it's about money. There's more behind. It's not only about Ukraine and about Russia.
Ukraine is a key point, but our people here as well. And the money is there. People have to be taxed properly, especially the 1%.
It's important to help the Ukrainians, but what about the people here in Europe and in Belgium?
The EU's energy sanctions against Russia over the war in Ukraine have backfired. Oil, gas, diesel, petrol, and electricity prices are through the roof. Inflation across the Eurozone is running at 10%. However, wages are not going up.
Many people can't buy the good food. Many people can't pay for our apartment.
Landlords are taking advantage from the inflation to
raise the rents.
Landlords will now have another excuse. The European Central Bank increased interest rates by a half of 1% on Thursday.
And based on the substantial upward revision to the inflation outlook, we expect to raise them further.
The national strike on Friday resulted in flight cancellations, according to Brussels Airport. There were also major disruptions to tram, bus and metro services. Union members, not just here in Belgium, but across the EU, are warning of protests throughout 2023, which will impact public services, unless their cost of living concerns are addressed. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The people providing the nation with care, asking to be looked after by the authorities. Some of the tens of thousands of UK nurses who have walked off their jobs demanding better pay and conditions. Lakshmi has worked for the NHS for 22 years.
Shortages of nurses have led to less staff, and you can't care for people if you don't have a staff to care for. So it's person safety mainly, and fear comes. Obviously, people are leaving profession due to unfair pays, overworked, stressed, and shortage of staff.
Hailed as heroes during the pandemic, nurses up and down the country, Save Scotland, are staging two 12-hour strikes this week and next. Their representative body, the Royal College of Nursing, says they had no choice when the government rejected calls for talks on NHS pay. The RCN says nurses are 20% worse off in real terms today than they were in 2010. Due to successive below-inflation pay rewards.
Things have gotten so bad that hospitals, one in four hospitals, are having to set up food banks for nurses and for other staff. This is unprecedented. But we're not just fighting for pay, we're fighting for the survival of the NHS.
One reason for that concern is the number of staff leaving the profession. 25,000 nursing staff have quit the NHS in the past year. The government says the demand for a 19% pay rise is not affordable. The unions argue the money is there. The nurses' strike is part of a wave of industrial action sweeping the UK this year, with the strikers demanding better pay and conditions as a worsening cost of living crisis pushes more and more people into dire straits.
The unions are warning that the strikes this month could be the beginning of a longer period of action if governments refuse formal pay negotiations or if future talks do not result in satisfactory outcomes. Saipur is up, London.
The Saudi-led coalition has once again detained two fuel ships, preventing them from reaching the crucial western port of Hodeidah. The Yemeni Petroleum Company says the two fuel vessels were detained despite obtaining the necessary permits and being cleared from inspection in the port of Djibouti.
Preventing fuel ships from entering Yemen continues to take its toll on the country's battered economy. It has led to an increase in food prices and basic supplies and has made life harder for the Yemeni people as Saudi Arabia continues its blockade.
Rashid Al-Haddad, an economic expert, says the seizure of the fuel ships is just one of many war tactics employed by the Saudi-led coalition to put pressure on the Yemeni people.
The Saudi aggression is always exerting effort to make life difficult for all Yemenis by depriving them of fuel resources. 70% of fuel enters the country through the port of Hodeidah, which affects 22 million people. The Saudi-led coalition is using this as a war tactic, not against Ansarullah, but against the Yemeni people as a collective punishment.
Considering the expected rise in shipping prices, Dalal, a local fruit merchant, says he will be forced to raise his prices if no fuel enters the country.
This watermelon is normally sold for 1,500 Yemeni riyals when fuel is available. However, whenever they prevent fuel from entering Yemen, the price of this watermelon increases from 1,500 to 3,000 Yemeni riyals.
This blockade has caused an economic crisis. The price of wheat and fuel have increased. We don't have anything and we're not even being paid salaries. We're besieged from all aspects of life.
The Yemeni government says the illegal seizure of Yemeni oil is an act of war and a violation of Yemen's sovereignty, which will be met with force if continued. Yusuf Mawri, Sana'a.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Most Americans do not accept President Joe Biden's explanations about the real reasons behind the increasing costs of living and say his administration has performed poorly in managing the U.S. economy. The U.S. president claims that Russia is responsible for the increase in the price of oil, gas, and foodstuffs, but new opinion polls show the weak performance of his administration and Biden's misguided domestic and foreign policies have created economic hardship for the American people. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The Wall Street Journal has covered this story and tells us more. The latest Wall Street Journal poll shows a majority of voters think the economy will be in worse shape in 2023 than it is now, and roughly two-thirds say the nation's economic trajectory is headed in the wrong direction. The survey conducted between 3 and 7th of December suggests, despite U.S. official claims and statistics that the economy is in good shape, and that inflation is under control, their figures and claims haven't altered the way many feel about the risk of a recession, something many economists have forecast as likely. Republican poll participant David Rennie, a 61-year-old retired executive with the Boy Scouts of America who lives in Shelton, Connecticut, said, "I just think we are headed toward a recession, and it could be a pretty big one. Interest rates are skyrocketing, and that's going to take us down." The U.S. Federal Reserve on Wednesday, 14th of December, approved an interest rate increase of 0.5 percentage point and signaled plans to keep raising rates at its next few meetings to combat high inflation. The move reflected some moderation after four consecutive increases of 0.75 percentage points each. Economic pessimism is strongest among Republicans, with 83% expecting the economy to worsen. Slightly more than half of independents feel that way, while 22% of Democrats feel that way as well. Democratic pollster John Anzalone, who conducted the survey with Republican pollster Tony Fabrizio, said, "Our economic diagnostics have become partisan. If there was a Republican president, we might see the reverse." Tony Fabrizio said Democrats aren't paying as much of a political price as one might expect for so many people having negative feelings about the U.S. economy. He said, "You would normally see that translate into big bad news for the Democrats. Younger voters are more pessimistic about the economy's prospects next year than older voters. Roughly 6 in 10 of those aged between 18 and 34 expect it to be worse over the next year, while 42% of those aged 65 and older feel that way." Democratic poll participant Kendra Lewis, a 38-year-old business consultant and entrepreneur who lives in Fayetteville, Georgia, said she is already seeing some of the small business people she works with act as if they are in a recession. Kendra Lewis said, "I've seen a drastic contraction in what people are willing to spend. When entrepreneurs are scared to invest and expand, that trickles down to a lot of other things in the economy." Lewis said even if inflation slows to a more normal level, she expects it will take some time to undo some of the trauma people have experienced in the economy during the past year. She said, "It takes time for consumer confidence to be rebuilt." The website Bankrate has also covered the same story. Whether it's the hottest inflation in four decades or this year's abrupt end to the lowest borrowing costs ever, Americans' finances haven't had it easy in 2022, and most aren't expecting their wallets to feel any better in the new year. According to a new Bankrate poll, about 2 in 3 or 66% of the American public do not expect their personal finances to improve in the new year 2023. That total includes 36% who expect their financial situation to remain about the same, along with 29% who expect their finances to be worse. Slightly more than 1 in 3 Americans, or 34%, have hoped that their personal financial situation will improve in the new year. The findings highlight next year's rocky economic outlook, as experts warn of an increasing likelihood of a recession amid the Federal Reserve's rapid rate hikes. High inflation on everyday essentials such as gasoline, housing, and food is also biting into Americans' purchasing power. Also, Americans had varying degrees of concern about their personal finances heading into 2023. Of the 29% expecting their finances to get worse in the new year, 18% see their finances getting somewhat worse, while 11% are bracing for their finances to worsen significantly. White Americans are more than twice as likely as Black Americans to expect their finances to get worse next year, 32% compared to 15% respectively, while 27% of Hispanic Americans expect their wallets to worsen. At the same time, 51% of Black Americans expect improvement versus 30% of white Americans and 37% of Hispanic Americans. The Americans who do not expect their finances to improve next year are overwhelmingly pointing fingers at inflation. More than 3/5, or 63%, say continued high inflation will be the reason their finances do not improve more than any other category, including the work of elected officials, 29%, stagnant wages or reduced income, 27%, and changing interest rates, 25%. The MarketWatch website has also covered the same story. A Gallup opinion poll shows over half of U.S. households say inflation is causing them hardship, a figure that has barely changed throughout the past several months. According to the opinion poll, which was conducted among more than 1,800 American adults during November, 55% of Americans said rising prices have created financial problems for their household. Its results were published on Tuesday, 13th of December, a month after the Labor Department announced that prices across the country had shot up 7.7% compared to the previous year. The Labor Department put the increase down to higher costs of shelter, food, and energy. Gallup said the November figure had essentially remained unchanged since last August. Jeffrey Jones, senior editor at Gallup, said in a post for the polling firm's website, "The fact that Americans' self-reports of financial hardship are leveling off rather than declining is likely to reflect just how much prices have risen over the past year and how much further inflation needs to subside before most Americans no longer feel burdened by it." Jeffrey Jones added, "However, the figure was notably higher than the 45% of Americans who said they were in the same boat a year ago." The survey also found that 77% of lower-income respondents were financially suffering from price increases, compared to 60% of middle-income adults and 42% of upper-income adults. It identified lower-income families as households, most of whose money goes towards rent and have a hard time paying their bills. Of the lower-income respondents, 28% said they were experiencing severe financial hardship, which Gallup described as affecting one's ability to maintain your current standard of living.
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosrow Shahi.
Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr.
He was born in Kadhimiya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shahrudi was...
When we look at the works of late Rawzati, we see...
There is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamarani that he says in Farsi, "Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid."
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. Well, welcome to another episode of the program The Teacher, an introduction into the lives and works of the most outstanding Muslim, Shia dignitaries, and ulama all across the world of Islam. I am Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sayyid Muhsin and Shaykh Rouhani. Sayyid Muhsin, assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Shaykh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
For today's discussion, we want to talk about one of the greatest, maybe among
the five greatest, we can say, muhaddisin, ulama, and faqihs of the Shiite legacy. He is no one but Abu Ja'far Muhammad ibn Ali ibn Hussein ibn Musa ibn Babaveh Qumi, mainly known as Shaykh Saduq. Before getting to the scholar life of this Shaykh of the 4th century Hijra and his magnum opus, which is Man La Yazurhu Al-Faqih, let's be more familiar with the early life of this Shaykh. Who was his father? Where was he born? Sayyid Muhsin.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, Shaykh Saduq was obviously known as one of the Qummi scholars, because the Babaveh family used to live in the Qom, and we still have his father's grave in the Qom, which is Ali ibn al-Hussein in the Qom. And his father was also a scholar, a renowned scholar, and the muhaddis, or the one of the main companions of Imam Hasan Askari alayhi salam.
Okay.
As it is also said that in Al-Kafi, which is the first book of the, you know, the four books, the first authentic book that we have about the traditions, in that more than half traditions are narrated by Ali ibn al-Hussein Babaveh.
Yes.
The father of Shaykh Saduq.
The father of Shaykh Saduq.
We have almost 13,000 traditions in Al-Kafi.
Yes.
7,000 are narrated by Ibn Babaveh.
Yes.
Like Ali ibn al-Hussein Babaveh.
So and all of them are authentic because they have been directly quoted from the Tongue.
Because he was
Imams.
One of the companions of Imam Hasan Askari alayhi salam. And then later, obviously, his father has seen the time of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam.
Yes.
So basically, family-wise, when we look at the family of Sheikh Saduq, they were the scholarly family, and he was born in 4th Hijri Qamari.
Yes.
Now, this is very important. Obviously, when we talk about the scholars, their life, it is good to know about the time in which they were.
Yes.
And they were very close to the Masumin alayhi salam, the infallible imams.
Yes.
So this time period shows us that, obviously, he was amongst the one who had the access to the initial resources, or the actual resources.
Because sometimes the Shiites are accused of, for example, fabricating some ahadith in the new centuries. But we'll say, as you said, as we get back to the ulama who were contemporary to the life of the Masumi, we can find it as authentic as possible.
Because about the Shia as well, obviously there is a doubt, like they spread the doubt that the Shias are made after the Islamic Revolution, for example, like, you know, these Islamic
Safavids, for example.
Or Safavids, yes. So they made up all these things. So this is important that when we when we're talking about a personality, when he was born, when he obviously passed away, his date of like passing away is 381.
Yes.
So he was at that time. So he was in a time period where obviously he was close to the infallible imams, or the representatives of the imams.
Yes, this is important. That's right. Okay, Shaykh Rouhani, what about the scholarly position of Shaykh Saduq, I mean, among all the Shias? Because the next generation after Shaykh Saduq, when referring to him, they call him as our Shaykh, our Sayyid, our, we can say, master, our professor. And with all these titles, it shows the high position and status, scholarly speaking, isn't it?
Yes, of course. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. You know, the scholars such as Shaykh Saduq or Kulayni or the other narrators and the scholars, of course, they played a very great role in the history of Islam, particularly into the establishment of the Shia school.
Very good.
You know, because, of course, the Aimma alayhimu salatu wassalam, they taught in their own times the people, the teachings and doctrines of the school of Ahlul Bayt. But their great role that was played after these A'imma alayhim salatu wassalam was this, the role of these great scholars, because they narrated and they transmitted those teachings and doctrines to the new, to the coming generations.
Yes.
That's why I think it is very much important. It's very much significant. That's why the scholars like Shaykh Saduq, rahimahullah ta'ala, you know, it is said about him that he traveled different areas like Balkh, Farghana, Hamadan, Baghdad, Mecca, you know. He went to the different cities to visit different narrators.
Very good.
Different people who have had some ahadith, some narrations from the Imam alayhi wassalatu wassalam. You see, at that time, traveling, for example, from Ray to Balkh, it was really difficult.
Real
and then
difficult,
from Balkh to Mecca.
Yes.
You see, so it was really difficult. It's really challenging to travel these areas, it was sometimes completely dangerous.
Yes.
For the one who traveled these areas. So that is why we see that this Shaykh Rahmatullahi Alayh played a very important role, considering the fact that at that time there was two dynasties ruling over these two areas. I mean, in Central Asia, there was Ghaznaviyun.
Yes.
In this area, it was Alibuya.
Yes.
So Alibuya and Ghaznaviyun, they were completely opposed to each other.
Yes.
So it was really dangerous for the people who traveled to the Central Asia, because mm-hmm. there was Ghaznaviyun. They were Sunni and extremist kind of Sunni people.
Yes.
As Sultan Mahmud was always saying that, I just searching to find any Shia, yes. any Qirmati to kill.
Uh-huh.
So this, in this kind of condition, you yes. see that this man, this great scholar, went to Balkh, went to Farghana, went to those areas,
yes.
to collect the narrations and the hadith of Ahlul Bayt. So that's why I think we must praise and appreciate
yes.
all the and appreciate these kind of figures, these kind of scholars.
That's all right.
Yeah, they have a lot,
yes.
Actually, right to be
yes.
respected, to be as commemorated. Yeah.
As Sayyid Mohsen also said, Sheikh Saduz belongs, scholarly speaking, to the Hadith school of thought of Qom, the city of Qom. But mm-hmm. as you said, many travels to different parts of
yeah.
the world to see the narrators, to find a chain of narrations.
Yeah, of course.
This has made the work very important. And his book, that is Man La Yahzuruhu Al-Faqih, is among the four Kutub Al-Arba'a Shia, I mean the four authentic Shia books, that it is very much trustworthy. Although the name Faqih is in that, it is a Hadithi book. How?
Well, obviously, at that time, there were different books
yes.
written on the fiqh, on the jurisprudence.
Yes.
And Sheikh, he came up with the idea because he traveled so much. He saw that when people had the issues, obviously they refer to the scholars or the fuqaha.
Very good.
To ask for the answers.
Okay.
But what about if people do not have a faqih next to them?
Mm-hmm.
So this is the first Tawzil Masail, we can say.
Oh.
The first law book.
Yes.
Man la yahdhuruhu al-faqih, man
yes.
whoever. La yahdhur, he is not present.
Present.
Near him a faqih, like
yes.
a scholar or the faqih. Or
whoever mujtahid, a faqih is not present by him or her.
Yeah, by him or her.
Okay.
So he has to refer to this book, and when he uh-huh. refers to his book, to this book, he can find the rulings about the prayer, about the, you know,
mm-hmm.
the fasting and all those.
But in a hadith.
In a hadith, uh-huh. with the hadith,
okay.
obviously.
Hadith based.
So
okay.
it's a hadith based.
Yes.
But obviously the idea was that the ones who do not have the faqih present to them, next to them,
mm-hmm.
they don't have a faqih next to them to ask questions, so they can refer to this book and
okay.
find the answers.
Yes.
So that's why the book was named like this. Man la yahdhuruhu al-faqih.
Yes.
There is a ha, obviously,
yes,
over
yes,
there.
Yes.
This is the pronoun.
Okay.
So yes, it is the book of hadith, which talks about the different topics of Islam, the rulings of Islam,
yes.
under the shadow of hadith,
mm-hmm.
with the hadith. And obviously, he has used the intellect as well. Obviously, you know that the time when he was, we had two big schools. One was the Ray, where he was
yes.
from, the Qom and Ray, which was based on the traditions only.
Yes.
Another school was based on the, you know, intellect only.
Yes.
But his beauty was that he combined both the schools,
okay.
and he said that if you want to reach to the ma'rifah, or if you want to understand Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, it is necessary to understand Allah
yes.
with the revelation, like the
yes.
aql itself, the
mm-hmm.
intellect itself cannot obtain or understand the theological discussions or the discussions that
but
we
have. But Asim Man La Yahdhuruhu Al-Faqih is merely the text of the ahadith.
Yes,
there
is
no personal reasoning or deduction
obviously.
Or faqhi look as the following generation of the Ahadith book might have, okay?
Yes.
That's right, okay? That's right. Let's talk more about this book, because it is considered among the four authentic, we can say, Shiite books. We will get, of course, to the other works of the other ulama in upcoming sessions of the program. But what about the main content of this book and his writing style in this book, Sheikh Rouhani?
You know, first of all, we should know that in one of those traveling of Shaykh Saduq rahimahullah to the Central Asia, to the Balkh, since those areas were a bit far from Baghdad, a bit far from Medina and Mecca and the central cities, Islamic cities, that's why these people did not have access always directly to the sources.
Yes.
They faced lots of problems, challenges, not having access directly to the ulama, to the scholars sometimes. That's why Shaykh Saduq rahimahullah wa ta'ala wrote this book for those people in those areas who have not access to the alim, to the scholar.
Okay.
So the very nice point is that it was the first attempt that made by the scholars to write down a kind of risala amaliya,
yes,
or the kind of practical sort of instructions
treaties
for the people,
right,
the treaties, yeah.
Okay, okay.
And that's why, so for the first time when you want to write such a thing, it's a bit difficult because you have to classify, categorize all the subjects and find out the authentic hadith, the authentic sources, traditions, and to write in a way that those ordinary people and normal people could understand, could make use of that.
Yes.
I think it was a great effort that made by Sheikh al-Saduq rahmatullahi alayh. That's why I think we owe a lot to this man, to this great
that's
man.
That's right.
That nowadays we have very easily access to these kind of traditions and hadith and sources. Even our maraji, they have easily access to these kind of sources.
And see how much easy and plain it was to understand. I mean, people referring to the Arabic text of the ahadith and got their answers for their practical rulings of the life. I mean, the daily life. It must be very much, we can say, interesting on that.
There's an interesting thing, like how he come up with this idea to write this book.
Okay, yes.
It is said like he was next to the Balkh. There was an area named Ilaq.
Yes.
Next to the Balkh. So he went there. There was, you know, the governor of that place.
Mm-hmm.
He brought a book next to him, which was from Zakaria al-Razi.
Yes.
And the name of the book was Man La Yahadhuruhu Tabib.
Mm-hmm.
The one who do not have a doctor next to him, what he has to do.
Okay.
And then he asked him, he requested him to write the book on the jurisprudence, on ahkam, in which there is the halal and haram. And when people read the book, they know about the halal and haram. So Sheikh obviously welcomed the idea, and then he started to write down this
very
book.
Good. As we said, this book has been welcomed by so many scholars in the next generation, and so many commentaries and interpretations have been written, the most famous of which are Rawzatul Muttaqin fi Sharh Akhbar al-A'immat al-Ma'sumin by Majlisi the First, we can say Al-Wafi, written by Mullah Mohsen Faiz Kashani, also At-Ta'liq al-Sajadiyya, Murad ibn Ali Khan Tafreshi, also Mi'raj al-Nabi fi Sharh Kitab Man La Yazur Faqih, Muhaddis Bahrani, and so many outstanding scholars wrote books on this book, which is really, I think, one of the most outstanding, authentic books and resources, even for the non-Muslims, to be familiar with the diction and ahadith of the Shiite imams, especially from a fiqhi look. That's all right. Okay, whatever. Missed? Anything missed?
About another very great work of works of Sheikh Saduq is Uyun Akhbar al-Ridha.
That's right.
Salam.
Very good.
You know, A'imma alayhimu salatu wasalam, most of the A'imma did not have chance to spread the teachings of Islam or the Ahlul Bayt, except for the three great imams like Imam Baqir, Imam Sadiq, and Imam Ridha alayhi salatu wasalam.
Yes.
So Imam Ridha alayhi salatu wasalam's trip to Khurasan had lots of, we can say, blessings and fruitful kind of teachings and outcomes for the people of this area. But the most important role that was played by Sheikh al-Saduq rahmatullahi alayhi in this regard is that he collected the most authentic sayings and traditions of Imam Ridha alayhi salatu wasalam, and he actually introduced this great imam to the people.
Yes.
And nowadays, when we look at those ahadith, it has lots of very deep and comprehensive teachings of Islam in Uyun Akhbar al-Ridha. For example, when Imam Ridha talks about Tawheed, Imam talks in a very kind of deepest or kind of comprehensive perspective about Tawheed.
Yes.
And it is collected by Shaykh al-Saduq rahmatullahi alayhi. And
very
now we have access. Yeah.
Yes.
And this these kind of teachings and doctrines that we find and the principles of Islam that we find in that book, I mean, Uyun Akhbar al-Ridha alayhi salatu wasalam, is really instructive, is really fruitful for all the generations and the history of Islam.
Also, Al-Khisal, Ilal al-Sharai, Sifat al-Shia,
Kitab al-Tawheed.
Kitab al-Tawheed, these are all the books.
Yes.
And I think those interested in, for example, translating the books into other languages, this must be among their priorities.
Tawheed has been translated in English, obviously.
Okay.
We attended. There's a very interesting story in the Tawheed where he's talking about the Tawheed, obviously monotheism. Tawheed means
monotheism,
oneness of God or monotheism. And there he refers to Aristotle.
Mm-hmm.
He said that in the history, we see that Aristotle has asked a question that obviously Allah wants to punish the people,
mm-hmm.
right? And he also asked us to be safe from the hellfire. So where we should run then? Because when he is the one who will punish us, then if someone has done or committed a sin, then where he should go, like what to do? And he brings the answer from the wordings of Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, then to answer to the Aristotle. He said that Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam has said, it is the verse in the Quran as well. فَفِرُّ إِلَى اللَّهِ.
Okay.
You need to run back towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And then he brings an example. He says, if you have seen a mother, for example, if she wants to punish a child who is 3 years old or 4 years old,
yes.
when she starts to punish the child, what does the child do? In order to be secured, he runs to the laps of the mother.
Mm-hmm.
He goes back. And then immediately the anger of the mother, we can say like it's melted. And she grabs her. So similarly,
yes.
Imam Ali has said that when Allah, you want Allah to protect you or to
yes.
save you and you want to free from the
yes.
punishment of Allah,
yes.
run towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
That's all right. Very good. Very beautiful. So many people nowadays ask questions about the ghaiba of Imam As, ajalallah, you know, the book Kamal al-Din wa Tamam al-Ni'mah or Ikmal al-Din wa Itmam al-Ni'mah in Arabic language. Referring to the stories of the ghaiba, the occultation, how is it possible? Was it possible at the time of the prophets? How Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala made a man passing life in minor occultation, major occultation, and all the concerns, you know, are answered in that book by Sheikh Saduq.
There is another book which is important, which
yes.
is Ilal al-Shara'i.
Yes, very good. Yes.
You know, when we talk about the Islamic rulings,
yes.
what is the reason behind
it? Behind it, yes.
And this is very important. Like
this is what we cannot answer
yes.
today to so many people.
So many people. And
so many young generation asked, yes.
He answered
yes, yes.
over there. He brought some of the reasons.
Yes, yes.
But he said, he also mentioned, this is not the ultimate reason.
Mm-hmm.
But also, like, although it's not an ultimate reason, but obviously he tried to answer at that time.
At that time, yes.
Around 1,000 years ago, we
yes.
can say.
Yes, yes. A thousand years
ago.
More than 10 centuries
yeah.
ago, yes.
So
yes.
He brought that book, and still that book has a usage
yes.
in today's world.
For sure. That's all right. 1381 is the year that this outstanding man passed away. His body was taken into Ibn Babawayh Cemetery in the Ray city, which is nowadays in Shahr Ray, near Tehran. Very close to Hazrat Abdul Azim's cemetery over there in the Ray city, and he was buried over there. And may Allah bless the soul of Sheikh As-Saduq, one of the most outstanding scholars belonging to the Hadith school of thought of the city of Qom, the author of Ma'ani al-Akhbar, Uyun Akhbar al-Riza, Al-Khisal, Ilal al-Shara'i, Sifat al-Shia, and Man la yahzaruhu al-Faqih. Really outstanding. Even one of them is enough for the whole Shiite legacy, let alone to all these precious pearls, I can call them, and jewels of the Shia legacy and the books. May Allah bless the soul of Sheikh As-Saduq. Thank you, my Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi and Sheikh Rouhani for a nice elaboration on his life. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher, which was about the life account of Sheikh As-Saduq. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/en/call-of-islam page. Also, you can send your emails at englishradio@irib.ir. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English.